Hey everybody, it's Hit Rewind. We are back in session. Courts in session. You probably won't know because there were so many episodes in the storage before we went on hiatus for, well, I didn't go on hiatus, but I just did a lot less recordings. But you've been gone for 3.5 months, right?
Yes, but I'm back. I'm still here.
Guess who's back? Back again.
Again. Jacob's back.
So where we left off... So the plan was, hey, 1990s nostalgia hasn't fully kicked in. We're going to take a pause before we jump back into 1997. I was going to go through the 60s and 70s. I think we're just going to go through the 60s and then take a break, go back to the 90s, and then maybe next year we'll tackle some 70s. So we left off in 1964, so we are now in 1965. We pick, I think, a lot of movies this episode. Sorry, six movies seems like a lot. But it seems like the old days. I could be wrong.
Well, these movies, yeah, definitely. Well, back then, I mean, gosh, I mean, what you had most of the time was movies or TV. And there were some big run times.
Well, and all of these movies seem to be 2.5 hours long. Am I wrong?
Well, just The Great Race. However, the other ones, say, were like close to 2 hours.
Yeah.
Anywhere between 1.5 to 2 hours.
Well, this is that era where they're trying to compete with television. So movies are now trying to be more epic. You have CinemaScope and Cinerama. You know, there was like 6 or 7 movies done in Cinerama, like ultra wide, very expensive, huge stars, sometimes lots of stars together, and big vision. You know, in 2.5-hour, 3-hour movies,
yeah,
which is normal.
Giant spectacle.
Which is normal now, and you wouldn't bat an eye if you heard, oh, it's a 2.5-hour movie. Like, yeah, okay, and but. This is that era as the studios are crumbling. People are getting tired of war movies. They're tired of westerns. The musicals are costing too much and not bringing enough money in. Right now, we're on the verge of the collapse of all the studios. And you're going to find at the end of the 60s, everything changes with... And no one ever talks about this. Planet of the Apes really changed a lot. It really said that sci-fi could be more mature and bigger ideas. And
oh yes,
an Easy Rider proved that little independent movies could rake up a ton of cash and really speak to the people. So you have the 70s is more, for the most part, kind of a malaise. The serious studio movies were taking over, and they had a lot of darker elements to them. But you also had the exploitation films, which blew up in the 70s. So like Little Guys could really compete with movies that cost like $500,000, $1 million. And so you're going to see a huge change right here. So what we're talking about in this last, like these 60s episodes, is that overhaul of the system where some things just aren't working.
Yes, and particularly, like with the Western formula, you know, they had to get it a little more grittier. They had to get a little less campy and a little less cheesy.
Yeah, well, I think, serious. I don't know if it's so much cheesy as a lot of the studios were not listening. Hey guys, stop making so many cavalry movies where the Native Americans are crazed savages, that there's no level to them. There's a few guys that were really pushing forward on that, like Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas and stuff like that, but you still had like John Wayne holding on. And then you had like the cynical side starting to come in with the spaghetti westerns. And so that kind of took over. As I get older, I don't really like spaghetti westerns too much because they lost their sight of, hey, let's make darker, more complex movies, to just making grim, gruesome movies, you know, like just pure on exploitation.
Oh, yeah.
They took everything wrong from the Fistful of Dollars, the Man with No Name trilogy. They took all the wrong elements from that. But,
Okay,
we're back up. Sorry, I accidentally paused.
You hit the wrong button!
All right, so, yeah, Marriage on the Rocks. Basically the end of the era for the Rat Pack. This is when they start falling in different directions. A lot of it's Frank. Frank and his blow up at Peter Lawford over not getting JFK to show up at his house. Do you know about this story?
No.
It was during, I believe it was JFK's, he had already been elected, and they were going to have a nomination or a election party at Frank's house. And so he had to build specific things for the landing pad of the helicopter and for security. He spent a fortune. And then all of a sudden, at the last minute, he decided no, he's not going to, because they realized that Frank had so many mob ties and that was going to look bad on him. And so since Peter Lawford was the connecting person between him and JFK, he blamed Peter Lawford and kicked him out of the group, which a lot of the guys did not agree with, especially Sammy. And Sammy was always treated like shit. They say they love Sammy, but they're always making horrible racist jokes towards him, whatever, and making him a laughing stock. Even though he was probably the most versatile of the group. So they lost Sammy, they lost Lawford, and I think Dean was just kind of tired of being, just watching the abuse, the second banana. It's the same shit that he had to go through with Jerry Lewis. So Marriage on the Rocks is basically the end of the Rat Pack. It's the last time that any of the guys really got together for years. Sammy and Peter Lawford would do some movies later in the 70s, but this is it. And at least it's not as phoned in as some of the stuff that they were doing during this time. I think Frank and Dean are incredible talents when they care, but they exhausted themselves by constantly filming during the day, doing concerts at night, and then not getting any sleep and not preparing and not reading the script. You can see the laziness is starting to kick in here.
Definitely. I thought that's what it was.
Yeah. It looks like go ahead.
I felt like Dean was definitely giving more of an effort, as he always would, considering like his experience with Jerry Lewis and whatnot and working in comedy.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I felt like Frank was definitely a little bit more laxed.
Well, Frank was a one-take guy. Now, I've read stories where he would read the script back and forth to know it by hand because he hated doing multiple takes. If that's true, right, then kudos to him. But if he was just like, okay, just get this done, you know, and get out of here. That was a terrible Frank impersonation. The story's fun, though, and I love – I can't remember the name of the girl. I have to look it up again. Deborah Carr, I think, is what it was, her name was.
Yes.
I thought she was fantastic.
Oh, absolutely. And then her mother. Oh, gosh, the actress who played her.
Her watching TV in all the rooms. And then she's like – it's so funny how she'll switch sides based on what benefits her the best. She's like, all right, I'm going to move in with you. He's like, but I'm single now. Oh, yeah, here's the plot. Their marriage is basically falling apart because Frank Sinatra's just not paying attention. He's not investing himself in the marriage. And on a vacation in Mexico, they find themselves in a situation where they find, like, oh, this guy who can give them quickie divorces, and they get into a fight, they get a quickie divorce, played by
Cesar Romero.
Thank you, Cesar Romero, who's hilarious in this movie.
Oh, God, yes, he was all over the place. Definitely one of the best highlights. And anybody who would, you know, watch the original 1960s Batman series would recognize him.
I think it's hilarious that he refused to shave his mustache for that show.
He's like, oh, no, that's not negotiable, man.
Do you know the Cesar Romero orange wedges story?
Do tell.
Okay, so if you listen to Gilbert Gottfried's podcast, you hear this story every episode, but apparently somewhere in Cesar Romero's life, he discovered the eroticism of having orange wedges tossed at his naked ass.
Oh my God.
So he would hire young men just to come into his hotel room, suck on orange wedges, and then throw them at his ass.
Hey, I mean, no. Hey, everybody's got a particular fetish.
The only dispute in the story has ever been, oh no, it happened, but it wasn't orange wedges, it was mandarin slices or something.
That was it. That was the one detail that pissed them off.
I don't deny it. Yeah, so then you end up in a situation where Dean Martin ends up marrying Deborah Carr, and they end up switching places. If you've seen that movie with Jason Bateman and Ryan Reynolds, The Change-Up, it's kind of like that, except there's no magical element.
No. Just switching completely different lives. You know, Dean Martin getting used to the marriage and family life, but always being the bachelor.
Yeah.
And then Frank Sinatra going over there, enjoying the bachelor life, getting away from the kids and all the responsibility. And to the point where, you know, he ends up, like, promoting Dean Martin, where he's even more busy and then has to, you know, go through Frank Sinatra's shoes. Having said that, though, Frank Sinatra's character, was just kind of too content and too relaxed.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, you know, gave his wife the motivation to want divorce.
Well, and that's a big thing in the movie for the first half hour is Dean Martin's always poking at him because you got the girl. I didn't. I wanted her, but, you know, you got her. And then, you know, careful what you ask for.
Yeah. And oh, how the turntables.
I think it's interesting that I almost feel like the studio said, okay, let's wrap this up, because the last 5 minutes really wrap the story up so fast. You're like, whoa, wait, what? There's no progression. Just we're done.
Oh, pretty much, yeah. I'm like, my gosh. I mean, again, it was all around Thanksgiving. Everybody wanted to go spend time with Frank Sinatra because it wasn't right without him. So they end up going over there, and, you know, Deborah Kerr just gets overwhelmingly upset until he goes back, until Frank Sinatra goes back to visit her. And then, boom, they're remarried again.
That that apartment or condo or whatever it is, the bachelor pad that Dean Martin has is exquisite.
Oh yeah. Okay. What did he say it was in Malibu?
I don't know, but I've commented.
It's in SoCal.
So I love Art Deco, but there's a movement somewhere after that called Sophisticated Savage. Nickname that's not the official name. And no one knows really what I'm talking about when I say it. I've only read about it in magazines or whatever, but it's his cave. His man cave is a Sophisticated Savage because what it did, it combined like bricks, you know, stonework to make it look like, you know, ancient architecture, but also mixed with modern day decor.
Yes.
So if you wonder what Sophisticated Savage is, that's what I'm talking about.
It was a beautiful palace and a beautiful property. I'm not
going to
lie.
No, I'm not going to lie, Pally. This was originally named Divorce American Style, which is interesting because 3 years from now, a movie with, oh, crap, what was Carrie Fisher's mom's name?
Oh, my God, why am I blanking?
I know. Well, it's Dick Van Dyke and Debbie Reynolds, right?
Yes, Debbie Reynolds. That's it.
Called Divorce American Style, which isn't too far off from being like this. So I'm wondering if they had like this concept and like, okay, we can get this to work in a slightly different way. I didn't realize that until just now when reading this, is it cut 14 minutes out of the movie, and I'm wondering if they took it from the end to speed it up.
Oh, wow. Dang.
Yeah. So because it does feel like the minute the Thanksgiving thing happens, all of a sudden Frank Sinatra's back at the other house. We're like, hey, we're in love again. I'm like, wait, you didn't come? There's no conversation, no nothing. All right, we're good.
Yeah, I know. It was just an unspoken agreement. They just had to look into each other's eyes.
Yeah. And did you see a young DeForest Kelly here actually being an old DeForest Kelly? They grayed him up.
Yes, I noticed that. He was like one of the guys at the presentation.
Yeah, I was like, whoa, he's not that old.
Nope.
Which is ironic since he always looked ancient when he was on Star Trek.
Oh yeah, it's just those bags under his eyes, just like with Susan Sarandon and Vince Vaughn.
Yeah, I got that with my I'm getting the crinkles, dude. You know, the folded crepe paper kind of thing under my eyes. Ugh, I'm 47 now. Ugh.
Oh, jinkies.
Yeah. What is our next film?
Our next film, Von Ryan's Express, another Sinatra movie. Kind of, again, going through part of World War II, taking place in Italy, Frank Sinatra's plane crashes, and, you know, some soldiers end up, like, kind of taking care of him and smuggling him for a while before he finally gets locked up. All because of Italy was, like, kind of resisting slowly, but it was resisting Mussolini and Hitler's rule.
Yeah. The, like I said, sometimes Frank Sinatra could really phone it in. I think this is a phenomenal movie and a phenomenal performance. I'm telling you, I sweat through a great deal of this because I was so terrified. It was just really stress-inducing, and it's such a well-made World War II movie, and I just, when I popped in, I was like, it was probably just like a time killer, you know, it probably won't make the list. I was flabbergasted how good it was.
Oh, absolutely, from beginning to end. Almost like Great Escape, but like yes. Really shortened down. Didn't have to stretch itself out too long.
I actually think it's better than. I know that's sacrilege, but I think it's slightly better than Great Escape. I think a lot of Great Escape, but just the waiting, and this is just go go go. Like not constant action, but there's a consistent momentum.
Oh yes, absolutely. And again, it's like done within like what. Less than 2 hours?
Yeah. He did two World War II. I can't believe he did three movies this year. He did None But the Brave, this and Marriage on the Rocks at the same time, recording all those albums, going on tour. Yeah, I know, it's just crazy to me that he would put that much work in. But None But the Brave is fine, but he's only in half of it. I don't like it when they put their name above the title if they're not in a whole lot of it. It seems like you're just duping the audience. But it's also one of those where it's clearly like shot in a back lot to pretend to look like Hawaii. It looks like it's almost a vacation more than a movie. It's an anti-war movie, so I respect that. But at the same time, I was like, wow, this is just dragging.
Right.
But this one, yeah, I really was impressed by it, and it does not go the way you think it is. Like, you know, back in the day when all the famous stars, you're sure that's how they're, you know, they're going to end up this way, this person's going to die, this person's going to end up getting captured, whatever. And I just, like, I was just shocked that they pulled that, like, didn't pull any punches, just let it happen.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, especially when they, like, finally commandeered the train, you know, holding two people hostage. And then, heck, it ending up having to kill us because they were going to alert the German authorities.
Yeah. Well, and then the whole thing about the train is stopped, and they have to take those tracks off in order to slow down the other guys, just to give anybody a chance, I thought was really brilliant. I feel like a later movie used that. I can't remember why. It seems really familiar. Someone used that in a different movie. Besides the ending, though, I think the scene where they're on the train and Sinatra has to pretend that he speaks German, I thought was really well done and terrifying.
Oh, absolutely. I know. I mean, God, they're freaking Nazis.
Yeah.
How else are they going to treat you?
Did you see a baby James Brolin in there?
Oh, my gosh. That's right. I did see his name within the credits, and I could not point him out.
Yeah, well, it's before he had facial hair, you know, and he was young. I mean, he was really young. He was like 25 or something like that, and it's just kind of funny. When you watch these old movies, you see guys starting out.
I know, it is. It's great to see. Like, dang, man, to think that's where they started.
Yeah. All right, what is our next film?
Okay, next film, Capaloo.
Capaloo!
Yeah, I love the intro. I love Nat King Cole singing along, you know, kind of like with Shakespearean play, you have
the Sears, or what do you call those guys?
Yeah, I know Sears was a name for them.
Yeah.
But the official name. Yeah. Narrators, storytellers. Again, wonderful performances. Great to see. And just the way the movie plays itself out, almost kind of like a serious situation. You know, Jane Fonda, you know, being a school teacher, coming back to her family's estate, realizing, you know, he's trying to be forced out just so, you know, the land can be bought. And just the way it unfolds, you know, there's some comedic elements and, like, then there are some serious moments. You got some shootout moments. It was just an overall very fun Western.
I think it's really hard sometimes in Westerns because this is one of the very first Western comedies. I think McClintock 2 years earlier is the first official comedy Western. Like, not a comedy. How do you say that? Like, you know how there's action comedies, and so there's not just an emphasis on one or the other. It's a balance of both. And
right.
So you did have a few Western comedies, like, flat-out comedies before. I think Bob Hope did a couple. But McClintock... No, that is a straight-up comedy. So I think this is the first where it's a comedy Western. And it takes the serious moments and balances it out so that the comedy isn't a distraction. You know, it doesn't undermine the serious stuff. The fact that her father's been assassinated by, you know, Lee Marvin playing a double role, by the way.
Oh, that was him with the silver nose?
Yeah, he's both characters.
Oh, well, they do end up being brothers later.
Yeah.
But yeah, Lee Marvin's performance. Oh, gee. Loved it.
He won an Oscar.
Really?
Yeah, this made his career. He was always a B or C level guy, and this turned him into an A-lister for, you know, 20 years until his death. And originally he was offered to Kirk Douglas, and for some reason he turned it down for another role. And Anne Margaret was offered the lead, but her agent never told her to the day that she still hates his guts for it. Because, I mean, this made Jane Fonda's career as well. And they tried. It got a lot of nominations, a lot of awards, and they tried twice to make it into a TV show. But they had to neuter the fact that he was a drunk because you really can't show that back on TV in those days. Like, even with Otis on Andy Griffith, you didn't show him actually drinking. You showed the aftermath of him being drunk.
Yes, of course. Yeah, you can only show that, but not them actually drinking because, you know, censors are kind of worried. It's too impressionable.
Yeah.
Kids will want to do it, even though teenagers do it anyway.
The one thing I don't like about this movie is that at the end of the film, he is drunk again. And the whole point was that he was able to function without it. And that almost feels like studio meddling. Like, oh, they thought he was hilarious when he was drunk. Make him drunk again. And that just undermines the whole point.
Undermines his character development. Yeah. What the hell?
Yeah, it doesn't fit for me, but it is a lot of fun. I didn't know that Nat King Cole was literally dying as he was filming this. You cannot tell, but he had severe stomach cancer, and he died like 2 months after it was done filming.
Oh.
Yeah.
Man. That does hurt. I mean, as far as Jane Fonda's career goes, I mean, she is overall talented. I mean, yes, her dad is the reason she's famous and would be able to get roles. Most of the time. I mean, she doesn't even deny that. heck, I think it was just like one little clip of like, you know, her answering questions on the internet. She's like, how did you get so famous? Oh yeah, my dad.
Yeah, I mean, that's how you can get into the room. It does help, but it doesn't help you get the role. Your dad, see, that's the thing a lot of times with so Nancy Sinatra was in Marriage on the Rocks.
As the daughter.
Yeah, and that was supposed to be for Mia Farrow, which is ironic since they end up getting married soon afterwards. But, I'm sure that Nancy Sinatra was able to get into the room, maybe even able to get the role if Frank would commit. He goes, yeah, I'll sign the contract if you put my daughter in this role, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
But a lot of times, maybe your name is able to get you in the room, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're able to get the role. And Jane got this on her own. So she says that, but I think she's just being self-deprecating because she's more than earned her keep, you know, as an A-lister.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, she doesn't do a lot of movies, but she's always been an A-lister when she has done them.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, but man, when she did Monster in Law, if it wasn't for her, that movie would have bombed.
I've never seen it, so I don't know. But
I enjoy it.
Yeah, we're about to go into the golden age of her. Even when everybody was mad at her for being in Vietnam, you know, they still to this day say, Hanoi Jane, or I'm not fond of Jane, or something. It didn't really hurt her career because she was still doing top-notch films. So for the next 20 years, you're going to see some of the best films with her in them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, I can never doubt Jane Fonda.
Go ahead.
Even 80 for Brady, I'm still tempted to see.
It's a fun performance, and it's kind of a musical in a way because they're always, like you said, the Sears or whatever they're called, what did you call it? The guys from Something About Mary, the Farrelly brothers said they took that inspiration from Cat Ballou. They're kind of moving the plot along with little songs.
Yeah, or like in the animated Disney Robin Hood film.
Is it that way? I haven't seen it. I don't think I've seen it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a rooster kind of like playing, you know, he's pretty much a bard singing along, setting up a story, and of course, you know, setting up the intermission and the end.
Yeah. All right, what is our next film?
Well, there, Pilgrim, it's the Sons of Katie Elder.
One of the few John Wayne movies you're going to see on this show or hear on this show is because I actually don't like John Wayne himself. But like Vin Diesel, he was just successful enough to surround himself with good actors and good directors. And so whenever I say I like a John Wayne movie, it isn't because of John Wayne. It's really rare.
Oh, no, of course. It's like, I mean, again, most of his performances when he's playing a cowboy is always based off of Wyatt Earp.
Yeah.
Or his interpretation of Wyatt Earp.
Right. I think it's funny is that no one's really talking about it, but you know Ernest P. Worrell took his outfit, basically, his setup. You know how he wore the same thing in everything, single thing? He took it from John Wayne. John Wayne wore the same thing in every movie. I don't know if it's because he didn't want to think about... I don't know if he didn't want to think about what to wear. Like, I don't want to, like, worry myself with costume. Just give me what I wear every single time. But, you know, Ernest has the vest. He has the hat, the same exact shirt and everything. And the way he carries himself is the same exact thing. it's taken from John Wayne.
Right. Yeah, no, of course. And I think this is what the movie... Brothers is based off the John Singleton movie.
Yeah.
Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, and I think Four Brothers is actually better, but This is a pretty damn good movie, and again, not because of John Wayne. This is Dean Martin firing on all cylinders.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, jeez. I mean, also, my dad being a John Wayne fan, like, he'll always watch this movie whenever it's on. And, yeah. I have to give more credit to Dean Martin. Everything else, the way this movie carried itself through its plot, like, it's, you know, violence and whatnot, that's what really did it. And, of course, you also had, again, the supporting cast, as you mentioned, you know, Michael Anderson Jr., Earl Holliman, and heck, even George Kennedy and Dennis Hopper.
Oh, yeah, George Kennedy is a nasty, sleazy little villain. He's about to get his Oscar nomination, and that's going to change a lot for his career, but he was a really dastardly villain for a lot of films before that.
I wouldn't doubt it. I think he was in a couple movies you mentioned before.
Maybe. It's Cool Hand Luke is what changed everything for him. And then he became more of a protagonist. Maybe not the star, but the lead support or something like that. And
Naked Gun was one example.
Yeah, yeah.
From my childhood.
The whole airport franchise.
That too.
So in this, what's hard to handle in both films, this and the remake, is their thirst for revenge. Well, and I guess this one, the revenge isn't so strong. They're trying to solve the mystery, and everybody's trying to stop them no matter what. But it gets the little brother killed, and that's always the hardest to take. It's like, well, yeah, you're trying to solve your mother's murder, but look what fucking happened. You just lost someone else.
Exactly. I mean, did the ends justify the means with
no.
that?
Yeah, it's hard to take, but it also doesn't flinch from it. Like, there's a movie called Death Sentence with Kevin Bacon, which is supposed to be the sequel to Death Wish, not Death Wish 2, because the guy who wrote Death Wish realized what a mistake he made and that people sympathized and rooted for, Charles Bronson. And he's like, oh, no, that's not what I want. I don't want people to go out to be vigilantes. It's supposed to tell you the cost of taking the law into your own hands. And this is kind of in that vein as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And again, the four brothers coming back into town, you know, they felt like they didn't do right by their mother. You know, one's a hired gunman, one's a failed hardware store owner, one's like, you know, a gambler. And, oh gosh, I forgot what the other one did.
Right. One's just a kid. And I don't understand this.
Yeah.
How old was their mother for one? And B, how is that even possible to have John Wayne, who's clearly 50, and the kid who's like 17? How the fuck?
Yeah, no. It is movie magic. Makeup. But yeah. Again, overall, it carried itself pretty well. And as you said, yeah, just George Kennedy being just so nasty as the antagonist.
What is our next film?
Okay, next film is Shenandoah.
Man, I can't believe how good this movie was. I was told this is, I don't bring up the person very often, but whenever I ask like someone in my family, it's like, what was the first movie you saw? Or what movies did you see as a kid? My father saw one movie as a kid before he hit adulthood, and it was Shenandoah. So it's always sat in my mind. So eventually I watched it, and I was shocked at how anti-war this movie is. This is like years before Vietnam really kicks in. But I looked it up and they said they knew what was going to happen and this was their response to being an anti-Vietnam, anti-war kind of thing.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You see that throughout the entire movie, you know. Sons are like worried about battles getting too close to their farm, you know, within Virginia, you know, again, during the Civil War. And, of course, Jim Stewart's like, if it's not on our land, it's not our problem. Yeah, it's not affecting anybody we know.
In a way that makes sense, but at the same time, there is something to be said about cowardice, too, about not protecting people who are innocent. And a big thing in this movie is the fact that he, the youngest son, has a black friend, and, you know, that's what this war is about. It takes place during the Civil War, if you haven't seen the movie. It's about protecting them, about freeing them. So sometimes you have to stand up for what's right. But I get where Jimmy Stewart's coming from also. Is like, well, I have to protect my children first, my family, you know, and not
exactly
get involved in this. But if you look at all the wars that we've ever been involved in, it seems like a lot of times the idea is right. Like stopping communism from spreading through all of Korea and Vietnam, stopping the Nazis and stuff like that. But then sometimes you see there's ulterior motives for why the people in power want it. It's like, oh, so this, we can go get oil. We can, you know, take it. I was like, that's not what you fight over, you stupid moron. You don't fight over resources. You fight over the people. That's the real resource. Lives.
Yes, exactly. And again, yeah, this was like the backbreaking decision for the South to want to concede was, you know, this particular right to own people. Yeah. And that was their deal breaker. It's like, shit. I mean, yeah, no, the North definitely was pretty slimy, especially considering the fact, like, you know, after the war was won, you know, they really didn't have much plans for people of color. Like, you know, to rehabilitate them, to help assess them.
Yeah. Oh, it's
kind of welfare.
It's that whole thing where, yeah, but you can't come in my neighborhood. That kind of thing.
Pretty much.
Yeah, that's why, and I really wish more Westerns would deal with the fact that so many people in the West that went that way were of color because, you know, they weren't accepted in the South and they weren't accepted in the North, so where are they going to go? Where are they going to have land? Where are they going to have their own lives? The West.
Mm-hmm. Which is why most cowboys were people of color.
Yeah, except, you know, Hollywood didn't want to accept that for decades until, like, the late 60s they started doing, like, movies of Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte and stuff like that and Fred Williamson.
Yes.
But this is specifically, like, just... It could have gone... The whole story takes a big turn when one of the boys who found a cap... All he did was find a Confederate cap. And they confuse him, even though he's, like, 14 as a soldier, and they put him in a camp, and that changes everything. And the horror, the torture, the exhaustion, the cost of all of this to Jimmy Stewart's family... is insane.
Oh, God, yes, absolutely. Again, yeah, that youngest boy did not have to go anywhere. And, you know, they mounted up. You know, they had some people look over the homestead. And
look what happened to them. God. And then, and, you know, that one guy, one kid just opens fire for no reason whatsoever and then kills one of his sons. And just the look on Jimmy Stewart's face and his reaction, that's when I realized, okay, yeah, that's why he's still a star. Like, his heyday, of course, was the 30s and 40s or whatever, like the Frank Capra years. But this right here reminded you, I'm still a star. You know, I'm still a presence. You know, I don't have to be a tough guy to be strong.
Yes, and then, of course, he spares that kid because he wants him to grow up and realize what it was like to lose a child, if should he ever have one.
I know, seriously, that should have been an Oscar award-winning performance. That dialogue is so strong.
Oh, absolutely. And then in the end, too, like, you know, his youngest son, you know, having to, you know, kind of grow up so quickly. I mean, what, traveling with those, like, Confederate escapees.
Yeah.
Getting caught up with the regiment, seeing battle, getting wounded, only for his friend to actually help him get out of there. Like, to find him. Oh.
Yeah, there's a really good miniseries that was on TNT called Andersonville, which shows you the torture of those prisons. That it was a lot darker than people are talking about. Here's the interesting thing is, you know, when I talked about in Westerns, a lot of directors couldn't handle comedy and action together, like the drama. It's weird that this is directed by one of those guys. Andrew McLaughlin is one of these guys who, when he was on fire. But he did so many movies so fast, I don't really think he paused to really take in the point of the movie. So he would have some that were a mess. Like, there's one with John Wayne and Rock Hudson called The Undefeated, which is just a mess tonally. It goes from really wackety schmackety to dead serious within seconds.
Oh.
Yeah. When he was on, he was really good.
Watched it.
All right. Is there anything else you want to say about this movie before we go to our last one?
Again, yeah, it's definitely one of the best Western films I've seen. And again, just like everything that Jimmy Stewart went through, and then at the end, for his youngest son to come back and join them in church.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about it. Yeah, the horror that he had to go through, and he still never had his son back. And then, you know, thankfully, as they're sitting there, he opens the door and just wants to just reunite with his family.
Oh, yeah, and it's like, even though they're always late for church, that was another thing.
Yeah.
I love at the end where he's like, It's like, oh, you did this to me on purpose. We're late for church. Come on, get ready.
You know what's funny is take out the whole Civil War elements, the family elements. You know, when they're just sitting at the table talking is what really makes this movie work, which makes you bond with all of them. And I sometimes wonder if, like, TV shows like Little House on the Prairie, you know, Ponderosa or whatever it's called, not Ponderosa, Bonanza, like, they took a lot from this movie.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Even from, like, his daughter getting engaged, it's like, do you like her or do you love her? He's like, I love her. It's like, yeah, no, but there's a difference between like and love, you know, that yeah. explanation, you know,
yeah,
how he eventually grew into loving his wife, even though he just liked her at first.
It's one of those movies you do have to be a little patient with because the big turn is halfway through the movie. So you just spend time with the characters getting to know them, and that's why you care what happens in the second half.
Exactly, yeah. When movies like this are, like, more character-focused, yeah, you're going to have to take some time to get to know the character.
Yeah.
And honestly, that's what makes it more beautiful, because there's a big, especially when it pays off in the end.
The final film, at the time, was the most expensive comedy ever made, even more than It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. But I'm telling you, it probably got greenlit because of Mad, 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 Mad World. It's The Great Race.
Oh my God, from start to finish, Blake Edwards classic. And again, people, this is, you know, very opinionated and highly, you know, highly regarded as Jack Lemmon's, like, best comedic performance.
Probably. It's funny is, so I think this kind of changed things for Blake Edwards too, because if you look at his career before and after this, there's hardly any flat-out comedies. Breakfast at Tiffany's is a light romantic comedy, but has drama elements. He had just come off of doing the two Pink Panther movies. And then he does this, which is 100% a love letter to not just, like, the old shorts, you know, like Charlie Chaplin and the Three Stooges, the Marx Brothers, and stuff like that. It's a love letter to cartoons. This is the closest I've ever seen to a Looney Tunes live action movie. Like, but without
absolutely,
yeah, but without the actual animated characters.
Exactly, for sure. And I'm pretty. Oh God! Again, it was also a huge tribute to Laurel and Hardy, who you know were classics in the comedic world.
Well, yeah, Jack Lemmon and Columbo, Peter Falk. They're very much Laurel and Hardy.
Oh yes, it was. It's definitely beautiful to see, especially because when I knew Peter Falk is more of a serious actor, you know, instead of doing like slapstick stuff like this.
The
and in Mad 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 World.
Did you?
That was refreshing.
Are you a Mystery Science Theater 3000 guy?
On occasion.
So do you know how sometimes at the end of the episode, especially the older ones, where the two mad scientists, Dr. Forrester would always tell Frank to press the button, Frank?
Yes.
It's taken from this.
Yes, and I'm pretty sure this is what set up Wacky Races.
It is. Like, I was gonna bring that up. Yeah, and it also led to two semi-sequels. One is called Those Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines, which came out like the next year, which is about a flying contest. And then 3 years later, it's Those Daring Dudes in their jalopies or something like that. But this, of course, there's a lot of chase movies that are also influenced by this. I mean, come on, the Cannonball Run movies. Look, right there, Rat Race, you know, is a combination of both Mad, 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 Mad World and Great Race. And I think this helped, kickstart, like, looking back at turn of the century kind of stuff. The Westerns and war movies are starting to wear out. So people are now starting to get interested in, like, that turn of the century prohibition kind of era. Because if you look after this, for the next 15 years, there's so many movies and TV shows about that era.
Oh, yes. No, I wouldn't doubt it. Again, yeah, changing of the guard, something new, something fresh and exciting. And this movie was definitely one of those movies. My gosh, it was just great spectacle, going from place to place, you know. And, of course, the whole iceberg sequence where they're all stuck in the snow. Again, Warner Brothers studio lot, but they made it beautiful.
Yeah, it's seriously 1,000 gags a minute. Unbelievable production value. The gags, like, they can literally be 2 minutes of screen time, and you know they've spent a fortune just building those vehicles or whatever gag that they're doing. And it's just set up punchline, set up punchline. If Wile E. Coyote didn't already exist, I would say it was influenced by The Great Race. But clearly, Blake Edwards like saw that and like the Daffy Duck and stuff like that or whatever and said, oh my God, this is the rhythm that I need with this movie.
Oh, absolutely. You can definitely see that, again, from start to finish. I will have to say, definitely some great moments. Oh God, the Borracho Brawl. That was just absolutely nuts. And then of course the big pie scene.
Oh my God, the pie sequence, holy shit. I will say this though, so the movie is mostly just vignettes. You know, it's Tony Curtis is like the Dudley Do-Right, you know, the I'll save you Nell.
Yes,
which is nice in this movie though. Is Nell really doesn't need that much saving. She is played by Natalie Wood, and man, she is feisty and strong and feminist, and I fucking loved it.
Oh, absolutely. And she actually spoke Russian. She's originally from Russia.
Oh, okay. And then, what's the bad guy from Dudley Do-Right?
Dastardly.
Snidely Whiplash is basically what Jack Lemmon is playing. And then, of course, he has his sidekick. And that's been done in tons of cartoons after with this. Is you know, like the sniveling like the mustache twirler and his doofus henchman.
Yes,
I think Underdog had that. And there's a sequence though. So some of the vignettes start to slow down and take a little bit longer. Like the ice sequence isn't, you know, 2 or 3 minutes like the previous stuff. It's about 10 minutes, and that really works. The only thing for me that doesn't work, because the tone starts to shift to more dramatic, which doesn't make sense to me since it's almost like a spoof, is the whole sequence where they're, you know, where it stops for like a half an hour, where they're at the castle with the prince. And while I'm impressed as hell by the sword battle that Tony Curtis has with the villain, it had a dead serious tone to it, like an old swashbuck. And I was like, that's not right. If you're going to play a spoof the whole way, you throw in some gags here to make this funny, but also like, you know, really exciting. That's the only gripe I have.
Honestly, quite when it comes to like sword fighting sequences like that, yeah, no, I always find those enjoyable. However, yeah, at the very end, like right after the fight's finished, Ross Martin jumps out to escape, but lands right on the boat, and it's like, oh, well, he's gone.
And Jack Lemmon plays a dual role in this one, and I think that also bogs it down a little bit because there's a whole storyline about replacing him and stuff like that. I fucking love Jack Lemmon in this movie. He's so ridiculous.
Oh, absolutely. Not only as Professor Fate, but as the Crown Prince.
How on earth was he able to top the absurdity of his Snidely Whiplash dastardly role with even a bigger ridiculous doofus? It's amazing.
Oh no, he was so flamboyant all over the place as the Crown Prince Frederick Hopnik.
Yeah, oh, like, and his laugh.
Yes, that particular laugh of his, and just like enjoying everything. Oh gosh.
So much fun. It's almost too much. Maybe that's why he took a pause for such a long story, because it can be exhausting with so many gags.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that could be.
Holy crap. It is -5 right now, 35 degree wind chill, and there's a kid out here with just a t-shirt on. What are you thinking, person?
I don't know. This kid has developed an immunity. Maybe he's Iceman. He's immune.
All right. So, of the six movies, what is your favorite?
Oh, jeez. I'm a little torn between Great Race and Cat Ballou.
Okay. Had you seen any of these movies before?
Well, I was a Katie Elder, of course. You know, my dad being a John Wayne fan. And as far as it goes for Great Race, only snippets here and there as a little kid, but that was about it.
Okay. Yeah, Von Ryan's Express is the only new one for me, and I was like, oh man, I gotta add this to the list. Normally we stop at 5 movies, but I had to add a 6th one.
Oh yeah, no, and again, yeah, I definitely wanted to end it with Great Race. A little bit of trivia about that pie sequence though. I mean, at first, everybody was having fun, but, like, you know, so many takes later and so many processes.
Oh,
it was getting, it wore them down. I mean, Natalie Wood almost choked because when a pie was thrown at her face, she was open mouth. And then, of course, Jack Lemmon was, like, saying, like, gosh, it's like getting hit with concrete after a few takes.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny is so both Jack Lemmons are in the scene, but they had to cover the ones so much that you couldn't tell while he was walking around. I think it's hilarious. I don't know how they did it. how does Tony Curtis last most of that scene without getting hit? Like, he almost looks around like, why am I not getting hit? I'm actually trying to get hit now. What the fuck is... Like, how do you screw that... If you screw that shot up and you accidentally hit him, because they're throwing and they're barely missing him, if they hit him, that means they have to stop everything. Everybody has to stand there completely covered. They have to take Tony Curtis in, wash him off, dry him up, change him, and get him back in there again.
Oh, off camera, he was getting hit, but he had a quick change of clothes. He had so many clothes on standby.
Oh, okay.
Just in case something happened. But yeah, I think when they cut... they did the last take and they cut. Everybody threw a pie at Blake Edwards.
Yeah, and this is it, though, for Blake Edwards for a while. He makes good movies, but none of them are very successful. This thing was a phenomenon. It was massive, and he isn't able to replicate a single hit. And for the next decade, he struggles until he reunites with Peter Sellers.
Ugh, yeah, no, it is a damn shame. No, again, he definitely deserved an Oscar, particularly for this movie. But as far as, I mean, getting an honorary one was, you know, the closest they could do.
I'm wondering if this did get, there's no way this didn't get at least nominated for at least production, you know.
Oh, absolutely. My gosh. Again, everything, everywhere they went, you know, where they filmed it. Oh, my God. It's a beautiful scenery and camera work.
It's funny, it says the most expensive comedy ever made at $12 million, $98 million in today's dollars. I was like, that's not much.
Oh, gosh, yes, compared to big budget movies, yeah, that is not much, but still. All right. Being a comedy, wow.
So it did get nominated for a bunch of awards, didn't really win anything. It got nominated for Best Song, Best Film Editing, Best Cinematography, Best Sound, and Best Special, or Best Sound Effects. It did win sound effects, that's it.
It definitely should have gotten, I thought it should have gotten photography, I mean, my God, that. Again, it's a beautiful movie.
Oh, watch. Gorgeous, yeah. Absolutely stretching the limits of what you can do with cinema at that time. They must have color corrected the fuck out of it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you can do that back then. I don't know how film works back in the day. They don't really have computerized color correction, so how did they do that? I mean, this thing is... I bet you it was really lit, though. I mean, I bet you it was hot as shit on some of those sets.
Oh, no, I wouldn't doubt it yet. Yeah, as you mentioned before, just like with... what was the one that Jack Lemmon did where he was in Paris?
Oh, right. The one where he's pretend pimp. We just discussed it, too.
Yeah, I know. I should remember, too.
Irma LaDuce.
The apartment? Not the apartment, was it?
No, it was Irma LaDuce.
Oh, that's what it was, yes. He did. That's right. He teamed up with Shirley MacLaine again.
Yeah.
Yes. But yeah, no, as you can tell, like, everybody was just sweating so much throughout almost all those scenes.
Yeah, those outfits were so heavy duty.
Oh, my God.
Well, then they had Tony Curtis for some reason show up, and he didn't look like he was in the greatest of shapes. Like, just puffing his chest out, trying to hold it in, having that shirt. You know how the pants are up just a little bit to cover the stomach? He's like, swashbuckling, I'm sweaty.
I almost was convinced that the, little corset that Jack Lemmon wore as the prince was like kind of an inside joke.
But I can see that. Yeah. Oh my god! How did I not remember this? Oh my god! I forgot right now. It's they're reuniting from Some Like a Hot.
Oh really?
Yeah, it's Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon. They became A-listers with Some Like a Hot. Oh wow! 6-7 years before this.
Oh wow! All
right. Oh, yeah.
Well, considering their chemistry, oh yeah, they bounce off each other perfectly. Even at the end, when Tony Curtis, like, you know, gives up the race to prove that he loves Natalie Wood.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, Jack Lemmon just shouting, I don't accept this win. You let me win. I challenge you again.
I almost think subconsciously the only reason that he can function is that he's always a loser and that his anger just drives him. So if he wins, he'll be happy and satisfied, and that it doesn't work for him.
Exactly. It's like he wants to win fair.
Well, no, he does not want to win fair. Why did he cheat so much?
Well, not necessarily.
Much? Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he does try to sabotage him almost every step of the way.
All right, everybody. We're going to be jumping into 1966 and 1967 with the next episode because I didn't realize that half the movies I wanted to discuss for 1966 I already did on a different episode years ago about spy movies. So we only have... I think we only have three 1966 movies and a few 1967. So that'll be the next episode, everyone. Have a good night. And Jacob, set us out.
All right, everybody. Namaste and good luck. Be excellent to each other.
and stay groovy, baby.